Welcome, everybody. And for my latest interview, it was such a pleasure to meet David Mannion. Now, David is a weightlifter. He's an astronomer. He gives cruise ship lectures and was a teacher for over 30 years. He was the head of physics at a grammar school in Kent. And we find out how David got into astronomy, calculating the age of the universe, of which we only know 5%. We find out about David's thoughts around teaching and why teachers should be paid more. He has worked for the Ministry of Defence as well. We find out about the educational journey that follows, why David doesn't think that university is necessarily right for everyone. We discuss the 11 plus and the concept of being in the middle of the road, how maybe Brian Cox is not the most typical of physicists. We talk about how we measure happiness, whether people who do well at interviews are necessarily good at the job that they subsequently go on to do. We discuss how money doesn't always reflect someone's worth, as in the case of footballers versus those in the caring profession. Can you judge people for what they said in a different era to now? And it depends on how, if we take a different part of someone's life to the one that we are familiar with, history would judge them perhaps very differently. David talks at the end of the interview about why he remembers the good times and why nostalgia is great so long as you don't have regrets. It was a really comprehensive interview and a real pleasure to catch up with David for the latest in my series of nostalgia interviews. My name is Chris Deasy. Well, it is a pleasure for my latest nostalgia interview to meet David Mannion. And, of course, David, I've interviewed your other half very recently, Linda. And what I know about you, not least from the photograph that we just took that anybody watching this or listening to this will be able to see, is that there's obviously a weightlifting element, which I'm looking forward to hearing about. And also, am I right in thinking that you are a professional astronomer?
Not quite in the sense that professional means you get paid for it, but I do cruise ship lecturing. My old professor, Sir Arnold Wolfendale, who was the Astronomer Royal, so I'm name dropping, Sir Arnold said, oh, I'm going off on a cruise. And I said, could I do that? And he gave me his agent. And for the last 12 years, I've done, I think, 15 or 16 cruises where you get the cruise for free. I shouldn't say this, should I? But I do have to give 4 or 5 or 6 astronomy or space talks. And I do have to pay the bar bill at the end of the cruise. So it's not quite...
Well, I find that fascinating because I've interviewed somebody I went to school with who does a lot of cruise ships, but he does a lot of performance. He's a professional musician. He's a pianist. Yes. So in your case, of course, so when people say that there's going to be a star of the ship, they don't actually realise that it's actually an astronomer who's going to be talking to them.
Well, I do actually have 3 degrees in astronomy, and I was a teacher for 31 years. So the ability to talk to 30 people is the same, I think, as talking to 300. Especially cruise ship people are more well behaved than some year 9 class on a Friday afternoon. So I don't mind talking to them, and they're obviously interested because if you've got 2,000 passengers and they come up to your 10 o'clock in the morning talk on, are there extraterrestrial aliens out there? They're interested, and as long as you're reasonably good, they'll be happy. And I've enjoyed lots of good audiences. In fact, I've even had people saying, oh, you're a bit like, you know, Sir Patrick Moore or stuff like that. So I do get a good kick out of it. I also do, funny enough, Astronomical Societies. A few days ago, I did Ashford Astronomical Society. And that's good. It's good to talk to people. And when I was a school teacher, I tried to run astronomy clubs. I tried to do things that got them medals, involving research in astronomy. Indeed, at the University of Kent, I used to, from Mason Grammar School, take students on their engineering education scheme. So for about 3 days, we worked with your engineering departments trying to build things. And I was the one who actually had 2 teams every year. And we were up against, you know, private schools. So Mason Grammar School did very well with our students there.
I mean, astronomy, I remember a friend of mine at school, we didn't have a GCSE or O-level in those days in astronomy. So,
oh, you did?
At least there was one, but the school didn't teach it.
No, no.
So he had to do it privately.
That's right.
Oh. And then he worked for NASA. I interviewed him a couple of years ago. Right. So I suppose technically you're the second astronomer that I've interviewed. but I'm fascinated at the popularisation of that. So you were a school teacher for many years.
Yes.
And is it through that, and is it through the contacts there and the fact that you obviously are very dynamic speaker, is it through there that you managed to get these gigs popularising the subject?
Right, well, I'm a fellow of the Royal Astronomical Society, which costs £140 a year. and in my journal, I think it was about 2009, so what's that, about 13 or 14 years ago, they said, anybody interested in doing this cruise ship business? And I wrote in and I heard absolutely nothing. And it was with Cunard. And I don't know whether, you know, it went into a spam box or something. But eventually, after about a few years, I tried again. And they said, well, we've got something for you in the summer. And it was going off to New York, getting on the Queen Mary and coming back to Southampton. So it was the Queen Mary 2. And that was my first with Cunard. But before then, I had an agent and I did the P&O Oriana. I did Voyages of Discovery, where we had 9 different speakers, including, I think, the Dean of Westminster. And he used to know the Princess Di. So there was all sorts of things, religion, astronomy, people who knew about sea lions and wildlife. And it was great. The only trouble is, because you had 9 speakers and there was a crew of 400 and 600 passengers, the company went out of business. Normally, Fred Olsen's Balmoral, for example, you get me, the astronomy person. Oh, and somebody who knows about ships like the Titanic. There'll be somebody who's obviously very good at doing bridge classes and so on. But you don't want too many people because they cost you money, whereas the passengers make you money. So you want 1,400 passengers, 1 lecturer on astronomy, 1 on the Titanic, and that's a good business model.
And so how did you get into this? So, I mean, is it something, because, I mean, childhood, I mean, I remember watching the film Contact, with, you know, the Jodie Foster film, which was all about how, and that goes into the territory of extraterrestrials as well,
yes. You
know, and the whole science versus religion interface,
yes,
or binary as it's presented in that film, and then it shows that maybe it's actually not really that much of a conflict of ideologies after all. But in your case, you know, how did this journey start? What made you interested in...
Well, funny enough, I was interviewed by the cruise director. He's the person in charge of all entertainment. And it's a great honour to be on. And he asked the same question, so I'll give you the same answer. When I was about 4, my mother was obviously taking me out. And when it gets dark at night, say in the winter, I said, what are all those pimply spots up there? And my mum said stars, but she didn't know what stars were. But that was the start. And I, as a 7-year-old, I got the Eagle Book of Rockets and Space Travel. I knew about space in 1964, about the Mercury, Gemini. And I knew from the book that we were going to land someone on the moon by the end of the decade, which is what JFK said, and he was right. But when you spend 5% of your GDP trying to beat the Soviets, that's what you can do. Now, it's 0.5%. It's a tenth. But with China coming in again, I think it will go back up. And yes, we will land people on the moon, a lady, someone of colour, etc. But it's not just to land and pick up some rocks, it's to actually build a moon base. And with that, and the gravity being 1/6 of Earth, you can move things around, heavy things around, and you can get to Mars. So I'm very excited, even though I'm in my 60s, I'm very excited.
Because there was always, someone like, I was born in the 70s, but you're right, the whole 1969, the moon landing,
yes.
And the various sort of films, I mean, Capricorn 1 was another one, but yeah. Sort of the way in which all of that was, you know, entering sort of public consciousness and folklore in many respects.
Yes.
I suppose it's the same as, you know, because you mentioned the cruise ships, it's like going down to the bottom of the ocean. It's that sense of there's a world out there that we simply don't know. I mean, our own worlds sometimes are confusing and complicated and toxic enough. Hmm. But that sense of, I suppose, the adventure, is it the sense that maybe there's more to the world than we can know? I mean, is that, what's the driver for this? Is it the hard science of it? Or is it the mystic element?
You'd have to say to Columbus in 1492, why are you travelling? Well, he would know that it's 3,000 miles. He just knew it would be a long way and hopefully he didn't fall off. It would be like talking to Captain Scott. I mean, why are you going to the South Pole, North Pole or whatever? Or is there a way through the Northwest Passage? It's just finding things out. And there's always people loony enough. In fact, there was some sort of Netherlands Dutch billionaire who did a Mars One project a few years ago. He got 100,000 volunteers who wanted to go to Mars. Well, I'm not being funny. One of my cruise ship talks is about going to Mars. It's 7 months. It's not a few hours going to the moon. Mm. It's 7 months. And it's going to be 2 years before you get home. And you know how when you do an X-ray with your teeth, they all go out the door? Why? Because of radiation. Ionizing radiation can give you cancer. So they go out the door because they're doing this every single day of the week. Well, going to Mars is 100,000 X-rays. So I honestly don't think you're going to survive that much. Yeah. So it's really dangerous. But there is enough crazy, stupid people out there who would put their hand up and say, yep, I would love to be the first person on Mars. But as the years go by, it will get safer. I don't know how many people die in plane crashes every year, but in the 30s, it was a lot. And my mum wanted to be an air hostess. And that week, there were three crashes. She decided not to become an air hostess.
I was only thinking the other morning, because all these artists, because when I listened to my dad's sort of old record collection and sort of thinking, all these pop stars of the 60s, a disproportionate number of them died, like whether Jim Reeves or I think Ricky Nelson, Patsy Cline, obviously Buddy Holly, perhaps one of the more famous of them.
Yes.
So it's interesting, isn't it, how that, I suppose at the end of the day, there are probably more people die on the roads than they might in the air. But you're right, the people will sort of do at least in their mind, they might think, no, it's too risky. And of course, when something's too risky, you shelve it. But then there are always going to be some people who will say, no, we have to take risks. We have to do things out of the box. We have to do things in a way that is, forward thinking. Mm-hmm. And those are the pioneers. Those are the people we remember. And I think certainly so, since I was born, I can always remember the real excitement, and I would see it mirrored in my friends from school, about the possibility that there's just so much about the universe that we simply don't understand.
Oh, yes. Yeah. I mean, we're doing very well with the James Webb Space Telescope. And before that was the Hubble Space Telescope, which has got a few years left, but 30 years of taking. And it's not just pretty pictures, Time Life book pretty pictures. We're actually finding out exactly how old the universe is. Now, when I was a student in 75, the cosmologists of the day would say to me, right, the universe is between 10 and 20 billion years old. And it would be like saying to you, as a young person, say you're 21, Chris is about between about 10 and 30, 35 years old. Well, what is he? Is he 10 or is he 35? So we didn't know. Now they say this, and it's interesting, the number of significant figures. Oh, the universe is 13.78. And I would say as a science teacher, oh, don't you mean 13.79 or 30? Yeah, they know it within 100 million years. Now, how they do this, I don't know exactly. But it's because of these marvellous optical telescopes up in space. So we are getting to know things. But as I say in my last cruise lecture, all of that I've said in the last four lectures is not very good. It's nonsense. Yeah. And I'll go, because we only know 5% of the universe, the baryonic matter, the neutrons, the protons, the electrons, the atoms, the ions. That is baryonic matter, stars, planets. But 95% of the universe, we haven't got a clue. Now, that's where the Nobel Prizes are out. That's where you can get your Nobel Prize. And, of course, I gave a lecture about 9 years ago, funny enough, at the Canterbury Festival, Science Festival. And it was true then and it's true now. We don't know what dark matter is made out of. We don't know what dark energy is, which is accelerating the universe. We probably will know in the next 20 years, but it might be tomorrow. It could be in 20 years' time. And that's the fascinating thing. So, yes, let's keep on exploring, please. I think it's marvellous.
And I'm fascinated about the pupils that you would have taught over the years.
Oh, yes, yes.
And you're clearly a very inspirational talker. I mean, just having known you for the last sort of 10, 15 minutes.
Yes, thank you.
But have you kept in touch with many of them? Have many of them sort of been inspired to go on and study this and look into this further?
I might get a slightly political with a small p here. You said what a lot of people have said. So there's parents' evenings and there are, what do you call them, open days. I see you've got a lovely open day for the University of Kent. So I'm there, wheeled out, and I'm really nice with parents and they think, oh, you're nice. But I can remember many a conversation with the head of science who will say, David, can I have a word with you? Now, I like the way you're doing this and I like the way you're doing it, but there's been a complaint about this or that. You can do very well as a science teacher or as a teacher in general, but there's no one perfect. So has he marked all the homework? Has he done this? Has he done that? And you can tick some boxes that I've done very well, and there'll be some other boxes, and you can just about get anyone on anything. And there's a lot of politics. So the head teacher, I was head of physics at Mason Grammar School, decided to put me on TLR2C, which is a demotion effectively. He says, but if you do this, 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 and this, and this, I'll put you back on the same salary. So, yes, I am good, and I was good. I wasn't perfect, and I will have inspired perhaps out of 5,500 students, 100 engineers, 20 doctors, and so on. And I will have helped those people that never became scientists to realise what it is to do science. But I think the rewards, and you see the teachers going on strike soon, you've got to really say, let's pay them. Now, there's five of us, all school friends, that we go away to Eastern Europe and we have holidays together, we drink lots of beer. He was on 120,000, he was on 150,000, he was on 130,000, and I was on 48,000. Now, we all remember our best teachers, but I think it's about time he started to pay us, because, quite honestly, I did inspire, and that rankles me. And what I should have done was did the PhD and gone straight into computing or actuaries or accountancy or whatever, and I would have used my knowledge and my ability with numbers to make loads of money and drink lots of vintage port, which I like.
You know, it's funny that sort of reflection, isn't it? Because I did my PhD in my early 20s. Well, yes, I suppose it was no early. I think I was 25 when I submitted, and I didn't have family responsibilities at that age.
Yeah.
And in a way, it was sort of like I never once thought about the financial cost. It is a wonderfully, you know, blessedly almost like utopian era in that sense, because, you know, nobody knew what the future had in store, but it was affordable in the sense that there were my responsibilities were limited, and my parents were always wonderfully supportive. But you are right, and the number of people who now want to do PhDs, for example, and will come to me and they'll have wonderful projects, but what do they say? Last minute, in some cases, they pull out because they have family commitments, work commitments, because they're thinking, you know, in order to do this properly, they want to do it full time, but do they give up their job or half of their job and register part time? Often there's the geography. If they're going to pay all this money to do a PhD, but they're working or have family somewhere else, and it may not be practical to move, then you factor this in, and sometimes they just say, I still want to do it, but maybe I'll intermit or I'll defer the application and we'll see. And in some cases, of course, you never hear from them again.
And I
think it's an awakening for me, because advice that I might have given my own self, or advice that I received, you know, when I was younger, I think I would have to be very careful about giving, say, to my own children who are very young, because, you know, you want them to do the best. You want them to achieve all their ambitions and goals. But you are right that sometimes it's the hard economic sometimes that you just have to factor in, which you're not thinking of when you're that.
No, I mean, my mother earned about £13 a week and my father left us. So it was straight away, University of London, you get the full grant. And in the first year, I got 800 and I saved 200. The next year, I went up to 1,000 and I broke even. And the last year, I got 1,200 quid and I lost £200. So altogether, in 3 years, zero. I then did a teacher training thing, which I didn't have to pay for, of course. And later on, I gave back 31 years to teaching. So, you know, I paid my dues. I also worked in the Ministry of Defence selling arms to non-communist countries, and I once made a tiny mistake. You had to put on what we call departmental expenses. So the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland sells you 27 for free on board. That means we put it on board the ship and you take it and off you go and play with your equipment, your tanks or whatever. And I went down the row and it should have been that row and I missed it and I went to that row and I put on an extra 14% and it should have been 13%. Now, no one noticed the tiny error, and this country, Great Britain, in 1978-79 got £40,000 more than it ought to have done. So I paid, with one mistake, all the tuition fees you can ever imagine, right? Because we sold more arms than just about anybody. And they sit there in jungles, rotting away. Because, by the way, if you sell some tanks, and the people next door, when the Ayatollah went to Iran, were crying because they had 1,000-plus tanks at £1 million each. But it's not the £1 million you're getting. It's all the rounds of ammunition you sell and the engines and the know-how. So this engine isn't working. You take it out. Here's your spare engine. It's much more than the million. It's 2 million. It's 3 million. So that was something that I learned from. And what you've got to understand is I then was told when I was doing my teacher training, well, you still want to be an astronomer? Yeah, yeah. I only had a lower second. I said, well, Edinburgh does an MSc. Oh, they won't let me on. Well, try. You've got nothing to lose. I tried. There was three of us. We got on. Once I got the MSc, I even had Imperial College ringing me up to see if I could do a PhD. Imperial College. But luckily for me, I got Durham, because Durham is even better at astronomy. And they gave me a full grant for 3 years. And because I'm thick, it took me 4 years to do the PhD. Yeah. And I got... But you see, in my day, and I'm not being nasty, but Tony Blair's got a lot to answer for. 10% of people went to university. And those people that couldn't afford it, like me and my mother, we were paid for. And he thought that 50%. Can go to university. Now, it's a lovely, I mean, why stop at 50? Why not make it 90? Because I was a teacher for 31 years, I know what the 50th percentile can and can't do. I am nearly 14 and a bit stone. I can't run a mile in 4 minutes. I never could and I never will. But I'm a weightlifter. I can and have in the past lifted 100 kilos. Right? Everyone to their own thing. So when I got my A in physics, I was one of 2%. And because I was a teacher in the last year before I retired, 24% got an A in physics. Now, you're not telling me that evolution has happened over 40 years. It's 40,000 years. And you can't tell me that the young people I teach now are 12 times more intelligent. But you can't just make everyone clever. And you can't just give everyone the opportunity to go to university. What you need to do is what my dad did. ONC, OND, HNC, HND. Qualifications that help you with your work and not all academic. And you know what? People say, are you a professional astronomer? I wasn't good enough, but at least I found out. I did the PhD, I somehow passed, but out of 100 PhDs, these top 10 went on to become lecturer, senior lecturer, reader, professor, and so on. It's very difficult. And I knew just how clever they were. They were incredibly bright. But at least I found out, you know, where I was, and I went into teaching and did the best in my profession. But I take my hat off to lecturers like yourself, Chris, because It's so difficult. And I've met, I think his name's Professor Michael Smith. He's at the University of Kent. And he does about 4 or 5 research papers a year. He has all these abilities and he teaches so much, the people of the University of Kent. I just take my hat off.
Yeah. And, well, no, thank you, because I think what I have always found is that you go to school. I mean, in my case, I always found school to be something I looked forward to. I never missed a day's school, except for the very occasional sort of illnesses.
Yeah,
but even then, it was like, no, I have to go. I can't possibly be home. And then you go to university, and then you reflect, as I do now in my... I mean, I'm 49, and sometimes you just think, gosh, I went to school at 4 and never left university. Never left education.
No.
Right the way through higher education, and now lecturing in the very profession where, because I did my training, if you like.
Yes.
And I think it's very interesting, because you then sometimes reflect on what other people are doing with their degrees. So many people, perhaps either by choice or, you know, design... not doing necessarily what they may have set out to do in their lives. And I always find it very interesting because we've all got those, you know, sometimes I find that we don't always lose sight of those childhood ambitions.
Yes.
And even if you don't fulfil them when you're in your 20s and 30s, they kind of never go away. And I'm finding, and hence I think that's why I'm doing this podcast, for example, because it was always the whole, I want to do something on radio. And so therefore, I suppose I am in this, or yes. in a bespoke way. But in your case, what were the sort of drivers when you were young? Because obviously you're talking about physics, you're talking about astronomy. But where did the journey start for you? And what were the sort of the decisions that you took as a young person that led you to where you are now?
Right. Because my father was in the army, we were moving around. So Blandford, which is in Dorset, didn't have the 11 plus. And I was told later that I was thought to be highly good at academia, so I might have gone to the top streams. I think they did streaming. Yorkshire had the 11 plus, which of course I failed. My father was told to get me into the Duke of York's Royal Military School, which is just down the road, an absolutely awful school at the time. And unfortunately, I got onto the waiting list and they gave me a place. And it was quite terrifying, because I was a very quiet and innocent sort of person. I got the cane for putting my foot on the end of a bedstead. I got the cane for not handing an essay in on time. So that wasn't good. My mum took me away, parents split up, eventually divorcing. And my mum took me back to Richmond, North Yorkshire, because my father had left the home and went down south. And I got into Richmond Grammar School. But you see, I was always reasonably good at maths and science, say physics. And because I knew an awful lot about astronomy, I'll give you some ideas. There was programmes on television which you could win money, and you had a particular subject and you had to do the £20,000 question, the £50,000. I actually answered all the astronomy questions that somebody failed on, you know. So I did my O level and I passed with a grade A, all by myself, just like your friend. And so it was in the stars that I would try and get to UCL. And you needed, I think, a C and a D, and I got an A, C and a D at A level. So I got in. But even there, you see, you've got your 30-plus students doing astronomy, and you knew Dane was going to get a first-class honours, and you knew this lady was going to get... You started to know after 3 years that you were middle of the road. And there's nothing wrong with being middle of the road. And I suppose with a PhD, I could perhaps claim to be in the top 2%. But I was, if I could put it in terms of weightlifting, I eventually won the British Students and Universities weightlifting, because by 27, I was reasonable. But you take somebody who's really good at weightlifting, and I was beaten by Gary Langford, Commonwealth champion, and Mike Keelan, Commonwealth champion. And I said, well, are you doing a degree? And he said, no, I'm doing a one-year course in crocheting or whatever they were doing. You know, I thought, great, I'm doing a degree. And you're... But they were much, 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 much better than me. They weren't just British champion, they were Commonwealth champion. But then they go to the World Championships and they go to the Olympic Games and they come 17th because there are 16 people better. And I am very competitive. But I'll tell you something, if somebody's better than me, I shake their hand and say, well done. Because I don't get jealous, I just know that they are much, much better than me. So I think I did right up to the fourth, to the last step. But there are people much better, and I did my best. And in a sense, with these cruise ships, you get looked at by some of the passengers as, you know, the expert. And I do know a lot about astronomy, and I keep in touch through New Scientist, Scientific American, and I'm a fellow of the Royal Astronomical Society, so I get their journal, and I keep in touch, you see. And also, I can put... And I'm going to say something which is quite against academia, but it's true. It's actually true. In 1984, you've got the magnetic resonance people, you've got the radio astronomers, you've got my group, the polarimetry group, you've got this group. And we used to go up for tea and coffee at 11 o'clock because the computer system would go beep, 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 11 o'clock, coffee time. We'd all go up. And the day before, the Russians had shot down a Malaysian airline. Everyone died. Everyone. 300. And I get my cup of tea and I sit down and they say, oh, I've got this 2.3 sigma standard deviation signal from Cygnus X1. And I go, and not one person knew or talked about this terrible disaster. And yes, they are blinkered. Yes, they are interested in one thing and one thing only. And I can understand it because they are putting 19 hours a day on something and they're very interested in that. But you get them to talk about anything else. I got the staff and the students to have a cricket match. I did a staff-student get-together, drinks. I did things because I was interesting, but... They are interesting, but not socially. And that's very, very interesting. Because, you see, Brian Cox, is it Brian Cox?
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, I wish I was an astronomer. Ooh, I could do all these starry. Yeah, the people that are doing it at the cutting edge are not like him at all. They don't play the guitar. They can't make conversation. But boy, can they compute. They can spend hours doing. And I once met somebody from India and I had to show him the VAX VMS system. And within about 2 hours, he was writing reams of computer language, which was way beyond me, even though. And that's when you meet, I mean, it's a difficult word, genius, but there are people who are geniuses. But. They can't hold a conversation.
There is something, isn't there? And it is, it's sort of the big fish in the small pond. Or is it the small fish in the big pond syndrome? And I had that, because it was only really when I left school, because I went to a school in Cardiff, which was, I suppose, actually, and thinking in terms of the number of pupils who went to Oxbridge, then it was on a par with, better than many of the grammar schools that I'm familiar with in this part of the world.
Yeah.
And it was very competitive. What I remember is that I was never the... In fact, I certainly came into my own at university, and I did respectably at school. Mm. Always sort of, you know, lots of B's and C's, but very... It depends on what your marker is. Because there are people who've got the straight A's and all the rest of it, and many of them went on to do wonderful things, and some of them perhaps surprisingly didn't. In some cases, they crashed and burned at a much younger age.
Okay.
But you're always comparing yourself... Yeah. How can you not to those peers?
Yes.
And you know, at school, I always used to think, you know, I sort of knew that I was just never in their sort of league. But then you find yourself in a different kind of environment when you go to a university where maybe a lot of the friends that you meet went to schools that didn't have that same kind of competitive edge, and maybe they were the only ones from their school who went to university, rather than, you know, it be the case that 95% do and 5% don't. So... it made me rethink the boundaries. And I've met other colleagues, indeed scientists, for this very podcast, who have spoken about this, that although some people's dream might be to go to the best university in the world to teach, to be a professor in the best university, there you'd always be looking over your shoulder. You'd always know that there'd be somebody who's... And even if you are up there with them, somebody's always going to sort of in some way, you know, outshine you and outsmart you. And maybe then, if you have a different sense of perspective, someone said to me that, you know, if you're not achieving your goals, or if your ambitions are too high, well, just lower them a little bit, and then maybe you'll recalibrate. And maybe that's what it comes down to, which I think is what you're getting at. Because if you feel that you're a failure, and I know people like this, I've had, you know, in relationship context as well, the sense that, you know, if you don't achieve the ultimate goal, then you're a failure. But if you recalibrate a little bit, then actually that cannot be the sole mark of accomplishment or success. And I think you've hit the nail on the head when you said that some of the best people in the world might not be very socially able, whereas you clearly are that.
Yeah.
And so you've got something, you can offer something that perhaps, not that they can't offer, maybe that they wouldn't want to offer, or it's not even relevant to their circumstances.
Well, the thing is, I like numbers. So I used to do rifle shooting, and gradually my scores got better and better, and I shot for the University of London B team. And I can tell you now, I did a four-card, average 96, two 95s, two 97s, average 96. We won the division or whatever we won, I don't know. I used to do archery, but I was hopeless at it. But I can just about remember what I scored on a Portsmouth round. You know, so weightlifting is all numbers. Mm. If you lift 101 kilos and I lift 100, you beat me. Fair and square, you can't, you know. I weigh 89 kilos or 88.55 kilos. There's no ifs and there's no buts. But how do you measure happiness? You're walking in the woods because of lockdown, in the Blean Woods, and you're happy. And you've got to take everything that you see and enjoy life. So say you're striving to be a professor in some Trinity College, Oxford or whatever, and you fail, is that the end of your life? You can't do that. If you enjoy teaching, and I used to enjoy teaching, but as I hinted at, the politics going on in schools, I mean, head teachers don't get there without a few elbows going into a few mouths and things like that. And I don't like that sort of thing. And I because I'm very competitive, if you say you're trying to measure my teaching skills, I could easily say, well, these students, four of them got A's. Three, you know, if you want to go down that path, I'll match you A with A and B with B. You know, so it's difficult. And also, you know, when people do go for this ultimate job, I mean, I've been on so many interviews, and then they say, oh, well, we liked you doing this, and I like that question, but you didn't do so well. And I thought, if I'm a bullshitter, and I'm not being nasty, if I'm a bullshitter, and I know the sorts of questions, how do you cope with some student who finds mathematics difficult, and you've rehearsed this? You might be absolutely useless with students who are you. But because you can speak well in 30 minutes, then you get the job. And because, let's say, you're useless, and this is actually true, a lot of people who aren't very good do go up higher so that they don't actually go into the classroom. So I think you've got to work out what makes you happy. And a lot of it, because I know you're in the Department of Divinity, is to do with helping people. It is to help others. I think that's where people get a lot of pleasure from, volunteering. So I'm enjoying, say, being on a cruise ship and talking about things that I like. And I enjoy cooking or something. I enjoy meeting my old friends, and we might go to Sofia in Bulgaria because on the beer index, it's the cheapest beer in Europe. And we talk about what happened at Richmond Grammar School 50 years before. So, but you can't measure happiness, can you?
Yeah. You see, and also, you're right, because these are qualitative decisions, and they will change. And, you know, often we are fickle as people, and what we like one day and what we like another might, you know, that's why people vote differently in different elections. Or, of course, they might be presented with different choices. Mm. But you are right in the sense that sometimes I wonder what people are striving for, because it can be money, of course. People, you know, money makes the world go round and all the rest of it. Of course, that might be a driver. I was just looking at Facebook this morning and looking at a colleague, and sometimes you see that somebody might have a new project, or they might be going to another university for something or other, and you think, oh gosh, you know, suddenly they're on this ace trajectory. But I also look at my own children at a very good school, where they're often set homework. They were once doing, not too long ago, they were set something, and these are my seven-year-old twins, I think Anglo-Saxon poetry. And I thought, well, I'm not sure I even knew at the age of seven who the Anglo-Saxons were. In fact, if I'm frankly honest with you now, I think I would struggle to sort of engage on Anglo-Saxon poetry or Anglo-Saxon history at my age. And they do all these things, and I think sometimes, gosh, you know, I'd like to be able to help my children, but sometimes I feel that this is going in a different sort of direction entirely. But then, you know, you suddenly find 6 months later the teacher's left, and obviously it might be because they're going to a better job or whatever. But then you sort of notice that the patterns, that people come, people go. And I found this in my own profession as well. I mean, there are plenty of my colleagues here who've been here as long as I have. I've been here 18 years and many have been here longer than me.
Yes.
But it's also interesting that you have a marker and you use that as a template for, you know, what is the right thing to do. And you're comparing yourself to somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
And then that person leaves and somebody else comes in. Or maybe you might get a promotion or you might seek something internally and so on. And everything is recalibrated. And then you suddenly realise that you might be facing the same issues, the same crises, the same challenges, but with different people at the helm. Whereas maybe then you were a very junior person, very young and sort of new to the job. Suddenly now people see you as the expert because you've been there long enough.
Right.
So that all of these things impinge. So it's not a clear cut, like with the weightlifting, when, as you say, if you pick up a weight that's a fraction, you know, higher than another, then you've won. These things are not so. And also, it's like I always find, as I discovered when I went to Hollywood for a honeymoon many years ago, you see all these Hollywood star homes and you think, oh, they're living in these amazing places. But then you think that their lives always seem to be very messy. And you hear about the drug abuses you hear about all the, you know, the failed marriages and all the rest of it. You think, but they've got everything. We look up to them. They're the stars.
But we shouldn't. I mean, I was listening to the radio this morning, and who's that famous footballer, Cristiano Ronaldo? I think he's just been signed up by Saudi Arabia, and I'm going to have to listen to it again. I think I heard, I can't believe this, $250 million a year. This is nonsense. The world, there's nobody who's got real honour telling people we shouldn't do this and we shouldn't do this. Money makes the world grow around, as you said. So I want 4 million. You're a better footballer than me. You get 5 million. And it's just, there's an arms race in, say, something as silly as kicking a football or a pig's bladder. Now, I honestly think that nurses are important, and I think, brain surgeons. And if somebody like a footballer suddenly got a bleed on the brain and all the nurses were out on strike and all the neurosurgeons were out on strike, you know, all the money in the world couldn't help that footballer. The footballer is looking at death very, very shortly. I think we've got to recalibrate the whole of society. And I'm struck by this cruise. I went on a cruise to Norway. And Norway, my wife Linda said, oh, it's full of cod, and she wasn't quite enamoured by it. But I remember going on a bus journey, being shown Edward Grieg's house, or Edward Grieg's this, and there's only 5.5 million people, but they've got a sovereign fund because they haven't misused their North Sea oil money. They've got a trillion. And they look after their elderly, and they look after their sick, and they look after this. And yes, they have high taxes, but they're all looked after, which I think is very good, you know. So the 5.5 million people benefit from this fantastic fund. But the thing that the woman told me, which really made me think, is in your country, yes, the top executive might earn 150 times more than the person, say, cleaning the offices or whoever the lowest paid person is. 150, yeah, I suppose that's about right, yes. And in the United States, it's 300. Oh, right. But in my country, by law, and I can't remember the exact number, but say it's 10 or 11. Now, you know how competitive I am, and yet I will shake your hand if you're better than me at lifting weights or shooting or whatever. There is, in science, a Gaussian distribution of abilities. And it doesn't matter whether you look at leaves on trees or people's height or people's weight. There is small people, there's medium-sized people, and there's very tall people, or there's very intelligent people and medium-sized intelligence and so on. But when you look at salaries, it will start off at about 10 quid an hour. It will go up to 31,000. Oh, there's 17 million people earning that. And there's people who earn 50,000. Well, I used to earn that. And there's people who earn 100. Well, my friends used to earn that. And there's people who earn 1 million. And there's people who earn, oh, for instance, the person in charge of the co-op. She's on 750,000 plus bonus, so there's 1 million. And there's people like the fella who's in charge of Persimmon Builders. He got a bonus of 80 million. And it just goes on. And if I try to draw the graph, I would need a room about 100 metres long, because you can see where the low people are and the medium. And it's a skewed graph, and it will just go on. And you can't tell me that somebody is 47 times more intelligent than me. I mean, all right, there are obviously the geniuses. They can solve problems that I, to be honest, I couldn't solve in 100 years or 1 million years. So you could say something like the Einsteins. But do you pay Albert Einstein, you know, 100 million a year? Well, you know, I suppose you might, but normally a professor earns 90,000 or £100,000 a year. And footballers, do you think they should be paid 5 million a year? Well, they're very good. And the people will point to athletes, but I look at athletes. About 20, 30, 40 years ago, you could run the 100 metres in 10.1, and they've lowered it to 9.6. They haven't lowered it to 1 second or 0.1 of a second. They're not 1,000 times better than Valery Bortsov in 1972. So the 4-minute mile was absolutely fantastic. There are a few people in Great Britain who can just about do that, but there aren't millions of people. So I just think we've got to recalibrate and start paying people not ridiculously astronomical salaries, because money doesn't give you happiness. Those people in Hollywood, then if they're taking drugs and they're doing lots of naughty things, it's not helping them. And if I gave them an extra billion, oh, I'm much happier. No, they're not happy. Their sons and their daughters are not happy. And so I think we've got to recap. But how you do it, I have no idea. I don't know. Is it politics? How would you do it?
Yes. And of course, people talk about things like levelling up or the big society. Oh, yes. and so on. And which, again, are again very difficult in some ways to quantify, which I guess is also the point, because you know, you're dealing with people's ambitions.
Yes.
And some people's ambitions will be lower than others, or some people might have. I mean, you'll always have somebody who'll say, "Well, I want to be on the moon," and it's like, yeah. And I was watching a film about this just the other day, actually, and it was set in 1980. It's called Armageddon Time, I think. Anthony Hopkins is in it, and it's about a white boy and a black boy in 1980 in New York, from different sides of the tracks, as it were.
Yes,
and how one has privileges that the others doesn't. The other doesn't. And it's so obvious as you're watching this that it's that, you know, you might have the best ambitions in the world, but the chances of actually following through on that, you know, there are all sorts of societal things along the way that are going to hinder you. So it's not as though anybody lives in a vacuum whereby you can say, yeah, that's what you want to do, you go ahead and do it. And that's why I think politicians are right to try and attend to all of this. But there are other factors at play where, you know, simply some people are luckier than others, or people know how to play the game better.
Yes.
And I wonder, you know, if you sort of have a more egalitarian situation, will some people just simply, because of their nature, just simply be better and in terms of succeeding in that kind of economically advantageous sort of way? Is it just that some people are always going to be more brutal than others? Some people, it's not in their nature to do that sort of thing. They may be, you know, the money is not the circumstance. It's about helping people. Maybe it's more about, you know, why people might go into caring industries. Oh, yes. or indeed in education.
Yes.
You know, so at the end of the day, you're never going to have this sort of level playing field, because even if you say we're all equal now, we all have a chance to earn the same, some people don't want to do that. Some people don't want to do that sort of cutthroat type work. And I think sometimes you see things in your own children. I do. My children are very young. My eldest is only 10. But you see things in your own children sometimes, and you see maybe a sort of a resilience that maybe I didn't have at that age. And you think, gosh, what if they end up doing something, almost the polar opposite, and that's not in a bad way, but the polar opposite of what I ever sought to do. And I think you have to factor in, you know, what I was doing when I was that age, which might have been in the 70s or 80s, compared to now the 2020s. So all of these things are perspectival.
I remember many years ago, the boss of British Telecom was awarded $500,000 a year. And the newspapers were saying, I wouldn't get out of bed unless I got, you know, $500,000 a year. But if you want sufficient people to be carers, and you make the argument, well, you've got to pay the really big numbers to get the best. Well, you still have to pay reasonable numbers to get carers. And it's just seeing what you can get away with. Can we get away with just paying them £10 an hour? Well, I think the lowest we can do is £9.63. Oh, well, let's go for £9.63. I know, should we pay them between visiting elderly people? Should we pay them for the car? No, we might be able to get... If you're going to do that sort of thing... Then, when the consequences come through that you've hardly got any beds available because there are bed blocking people that are not sick, but you can't put them back into society, you've got to look at all the consequences. And I don't think our society has. And if you are too cutthroat, and some people, I mean, I used to watch The Apprentice. I enjoy that because of the sort of stupidity of some of them. But I do admire, because I don't think, even if I was 25 again, I could be any better than them. They do have that determination. And as you say, if you've got a determination to make money, you might cut corners or do some marvellous things. And I don't have those abilities whatsoever. But we all need each other, don't we? And if it's all to do with money, then you won't get the carers that you require. And there's been some terrible disasters, famous cases where, I'm trying to think of the poor children that have died tragically because somebody's has a caseload of 47 and didn't notice that the parents have been ill-treating the... If you find that people are overworked, they're not going to do a good job, but if it leads to death, then you've got to look at society and think something's wrong.
And I think the key word here, which you have in spades, is hinterland. Mm. Because, I mean, I was just reflecting on what you were saying there about how we get paid and the job that we do.
Yes.
And people might go, you know, some people might do a fixed hour's work, although even that, you know, some people might do in 20 minutes what it might take somebody else an hour to do.
Oh, yes.
So, you know, do you pay them the same? And in my case, I mean, I do this podcast. Now, I don't get paid for doing that in the sense that it's my own bespoke thing, but it's obviously related to my work. I look at nostalgia, and a lot of the people I interview are people who work in this university environment. So a very obvious case can be made for doing it. But I suppose technically it's extracurricular. But if I wasn't doing this podcast, for example, then I'm not sure I'd enjoy the rest of what I do quite so much, because the things that I learn from these sort of conversations definitely inform my teaching, they definitely inform my research, and also they give me that wider hinterland in life, which I think we all often benefit from. So we, you know, there was something, I mean, this obviously won't go out immediately, but you'll be familiar with the story that was in the news yesterday of a very senior royal aide. I think she was the sister of William Waldegrave, who was a cabinet minister in the 80s and 90s, and she's been the Queen's sort of chief lady in waiting since 1960.
Oh, yes.
And she said something very inappropriate at a charity event just this week. Now, she's been doing that job for 63 years, and suddenly, you know, she's now resigned, and it's all very embarrassing for the royal family. But you sort of look at these things sometimes, and you sort of wonder how people get by doing the job that they do, whether sometimes people do things completely inappropriate or they do it in the public domain or they get away with it or whatever. There's all these sort of things. And you sometimes think it's so impossible to be able to say this is what somebody does. This is the marker of them as a person. This is their great accomplishment.
No, that was very inappropriate. And, of course, very bad timing for Prince William and Kate on their visit to the United States of America. And I think, is it Prince Harry? I'm not very good on the royal family. Prince Harry's got something on with Netflix, castigating, no doubt, members of his own family, close family. It's a great shame. But I told you about the telescope. I don't know much about the person, but it's named after somebody famous in NASA, James Webb Space Telescope. So must have been a person called James Webb. But he said inappropriate things in the late, perhaps, 50s and 60s. But can you judge somebody if you're looking back over 50, 60 years? You wouldn't say that now. Which country are you from? And going on and on and on and making the person feel uncomfortable. Why the person couldn't see that the other person was uncomfortable, I don't know. But we're talking as people that hopefully wouldn't do that. But if you go back to the 50s, they might think, well, what's wrong with that? And again, I was listening to the radio, and this person's fought a very big case in the United States and only won 10 years later because sexual inappropriate behaviour was all right in the 70s, and it took at least 10 years before you could prove to the judge that this was not quite right. Because of your idea of nostalgia, the society changes very, very slowly. There might be, like in evolution, a sudden jump, like there was single-cell creatures for 2 billion years, and then suddenly there was a jump and you had multicellular life. And then some creature decided to go on land about 550 million years ago.
I think what you're pointing at is that often it takes maybe another generation. It takes us to die before people, if they should want to, can see our worth. Because we were talking about, I think, painters earlier, weren't we? Or we were talking about Picasso, or were we talking about Einstein?
Oh, yeah.
And this, I think, is the really telling thing, is that you're often looking at the legacy, something that is bequeathed by an artist or a scientist after they've died. And in that sense, you might look and say, yes, if it hadn't been for that, you know, you wouldn't have space travel or whatever, you know, along the way. There's all these sort of things that sort of matter. And often, of course, that's the thing, that we don't necessarily, in that sense, judge people by their financial worth. But if it isn't sometimes for their financial circumstances, they might not be in a position to do all the wonderful things that they do. So you've got all of these sort of different competing things that you it's easy. I mean, look at, you mentioned Tony Blair earlier. I mean, if he'd left office after the 2001 election, people might have said, gosh, he did some wonderful things. Maybe he was a bit cautious, but they might say that thinking of minimum wage or devolution. But it's the Iraq war that obviously is the thing that sort of undid him. So it's easy to, if you look at the 10 years that he was in office, he did win an election after the Iraq war. Then you know, then there are people who will always say he's a war criminal. But if you were to base him on his time as leader of the opposition following the death of John Smith, and he radiated hope, and also youth, he was only in his early-ish 40s when he became leader. So in that sense, you have a very different sort of marker to the one that people might use now in retrospect. And I wonder, in that sense, at what point anybody can really have that sense of perspective on their own lives. And whether it really is for history to judge what somebody's perspective, the context is. And some people will always be forgotten. Some people will simply, even by their own family, sadly, may never be remembered. Whereas other people might, since they've died, actually take on a completely new kind of dimension.
Well, Linda would probably give you the quote, "History is always written by the victors." And she is a great one for Owen Glyndwr, who was defeated by, you know, huge armies, Henry IV or whatever the king was. But he was fighting for Wales. And in those days, if you spoke Welsh, they would cut off one finger or two fingers, and then they would just cut off your hand. You were put down. So it's important to realise, if you looked at Tony Blair at some point in time, 2001, you might say, great person. 2021... a warmonger. But who's to say in 100 years' time he might be thought of like Winston Churchill? But I know that lots of people realise that Winston Churchill was a bit of a warmonger. Shakespeare. He put down lots of things in his premiership. I remember going to Winston Churchill's home, National Trust, all that, and you see lots of beautiful medals and coats. And he received numerous awards. He was thought of as a great leader in the wartime. But there's a lovely letter, and it's from one of his daughters. Dear Daddy, I like that, not dear father, Daddy. So this is a 25-year-old woman saying Daddy. And she says, aren't the British people totally miserable to have voted you out of office, etc., etc.? I said, no, because I'm now showing some of my politics here. No, when you come back, you wanted to be coming back to proper homes, proper... They seen what the officer class were like, you know, and they didn't want to be led by donkeys. And there was a 105-seat majority for the Labour Party, and they brought in the National Health Service. And my mum was one of the first of 200 civil servants drafted in. She was a clerical officer, to actually get the blinking thing started, because you've got to pay National Health Service... what do you call it, national insurance, and you have to pay doctors. Now, doctors at the time were very against this because, you know, you call me out and I charge you and you have to pay the bill there and then. And I don't want your chickens and your lamb or whatnot. I want, you know, 10 shillings and sevenpence or whatever it is, that my call-out fee. So, but if now people think, you know, the National Health Service is marvellous. And it's creaking at the seams. Well, being a sort of mathematician, what I would do with my friend who's a GP, I'd say, well, how many people get lung cancer? How many people get a kidney complaint? How many? And I'd look at people, I would look at the 68 million, and I'd work out the total cost. And then I'd divide it amongst the 68 million. And if we pay £2,327 a year on average, and Germany pays £4,960, by the way, I'm inventing numbers, I would make sure that we aren't 9th, 10th, 11th in Europe for paying our NHS. I'd make sure that we're number one, apart from Norway, because they got a trillion. I'm afraid that's what it would cost. And for instance, I have worked in the private sector, and I knew a school, I won't mention a school, and they used to pay about 12,000-13,000 a year. And I worked, funny enough, up the road in a college that had Chinese, Russian, Japanese students. And I know how much they paid, 32,000 a year. But if the average person pays 4,000 a year for state school education, well, I'm sorry, they're not paying enough. Either they're not paying enough, or these people that can afford to pay 20, or as in the case of Winchester, 45,000. By the way, that's just the bottom number. There's uniforms, there's books, there's rifle shooting, there's horse jumping, and all the rest of it. People don't realise the difference, the huge gap between wealth. And I noticed the huge gap in wealth because my father wanted me to join the oldest regiment in the British Army, the Honourable Artillery Company. Now, I was in the civil service. I was on about 2,000 a year, and I turned up, and my father said, well, you like rifle shooting? Yeah, they do rifle shooting. It's the Territorial Army. You like marching around? Well, I don't mind marching around. So I went there, and I met the captain, and the captain said, what's your name? David Mannion. Ministry of Defence. Oh, this is Ponsonby Smythe, Lloyds Bank International. Hello, jolly old chairman. And I met all these who are our Henrys. And I met also the Sergeant Major. And the Sergeant Major was a very large man. And I was trying to help him. I said, you get about 200 quid a year. That's right, sir. You get £200 a year, but that doesn't pay for the polo ponies, sir. Polo ponies? That's right, sir. Everyone has a polo pony. Oh, right. Because I'm thinking I might get a bit of extra money instead of my 2,000 with the civil servant. I might get a bit more pay. So I thought, And I said, well, you get every summer to do 6 weeks marching and whatnot. Yes, sir. We go to the Brecon Beacons, sir. Oh, Brecon Beacons. Yeah. Sir. Last year, sir, two people died on the Brecon Beacons, sir. And I know about the army, and every year lots of people die because they either drink too much or they parachute in and they die in the Kiel Canal, you know, drowned. And one poor fella was stupid enough to sort of sleep underneath his tank, and it rained a lot and the tank sank and you can't you know, deal with a 60-ton tank on you, you get crushed. So I knew about death, and I knew that this could be a dangerous sort of thing to do. So when the captain said, because we'd all been drinking, would you like to get the Queen's shilling and sign up? As they moved towards one door, I ran out the other door as fast as I could. Because no way would I actually join the British Army and do that sort of thing. Yeah. What were we talking about?
I was actually, this is a perfect seg. As we start to wind up, I was just thinking about this sort of, which you've done actually brilliantly, but yes. Surveying your whole life and career. Yeah. I mean, because I do this project on nostalgia,
yes,
I suppose I'm interested in that sort of question about how people, in many ways, I think nostalgia is about where we are now and that sort of reflecting that we do, rather than about the past per se. It's not about what happened 20, 30 years ago. It's about our perspective on the past 20, 30 years ago, or whatever it might be. So would you say that your memories are predominantly positive ones as you look back on your life and career?
Yes. I know people who have suffered in relationships and they can't remember the bad times. So I can remember the good times, and that's just natural. So would I change anything? I mean, yes, I mean, I could wave a magic wand and become an accountant at 22 and have loads of money. But you'd always think, could I have been an astronomer? Well, I tried. I really tried. All right, I failed, but I did the best I could, and I have no regrets. So I think I did as well as I could with teaching, and I became, you know, head of science in a particular school, and I did, I think, particularly well up to a point. And I've helped, as I said, 5,500 kids. That's what I estimate that I've managed to do. But I've had some fantastic times, and I think... with my wife, Linda, I think we've had a really good time. And I wouldn't change anything, to be honest with you. I think if you can strive to do as well as you can in whatever field that you're doing, and you've got ambitions, but they're not silly things like, I want to be Prime Minister. I remember Harold Wilson in the programme saying that when he was about 10, I can't believe this, but it must be true, He, in those days, you could walk down Downing Street. There was no, I think it was a police officer, but that was it. Yeah. And he will have said to his parents on a holiday, one day I'm going to be, you know, Prime Minister. Well, interview the 4,700 other people that never became Prime Minister. You only meet the people that works. But yes, as long as you don't think too highly of yourself, I think you've got to set yourself some goals. But is it from management? They've got to be targeted, don't they? They've got to be time limited and achievable and all this. So, but I've met people like one of Linda's sons, I won't mention who's very laid back. And I'm very ambitious. And if I had half his intelligence or half his abilities, because he's brilliant at computing, he would have done marvellous things. Now, he's all right. He's happy. And he gets to go on holiday and does the things that he wants to. So he hasn't got this tremendous drive. But if he hasn't got the tremendous drive and is still happy, then that's all you can ask for. Yeah. So, I wouldn't change anything.
And you just made me think, actually, that there is a photograph of me my sister.
Yes.
And it must have been when Jim Callaghan, I think it was 1978, standing outside 10 Downing Street.
You were allowed.
So I think it was after Margaret Thatcher became leader that all changed.
Iron gates.
Absolutely, yeah. So and the last time I walked past Downing Street, of course, you're very aware that this is no longer somewhere that you can obviously take photographs through the iron. The gates, but you certainly wouldn't be allowed into the streets.
No, I think the only time is if you had an enormous petition.
Yeah.
And you get handed in. Because I love the fact that when people try and knock on the door opens so they know that you're there. And I like the fact that the BBC or Sky TV are outside. But it's been really odd in the last 3 months, hasn't it? People bringing out lectern saying, I'm going to do this, and then 42 days later.
Well, maybe it's a bit closer to that adage about Harold Wilson, that maybe more people will have a chance to be Prime Minister in their lifetime. Everyone will have a go. And we were joking, I think, when people were saying, you know, when at one point it was like, we're having Prime Ministers who are lasting not very long, no. And we don't know what's going to happen now that, you know, everyone can have a chance to be Prime Minister for a day. But my very last question, yes. David, would you consider yourself to be a looking back or a looking forward kind of person?
My wife always tells me you keep talking about the past, but I think nostalgia is a lovely word. I think as long as you don't have regrets, you can you do things to make happy memories. There's these awful things on television where somebody's been told that they only have 6 months to live and so on, and they've got to make every day a memorable day. Well, I've had memorable days, and I'm allowed to open the box and look at them and smile. But if you have had happy times, then you must look forward. Now, my wife and I are going to this lovely place called Eastbourne, and already she's looking at, and I'm sorry to say she's looked at Facebook. I don't do Facebook. But straight away, people on this page dealing with Eastbourne have welcomed her. I think she's had 40 messages. So this is looking good. We'll join, cordon bleu cooking or learn French or whatever we'll do. She wants to carry on with her German. So we'll do that. Also, I'm not saying I know everything about Kent, but I have been to Deal, Sandwich, Broadstairs and so on over 10 years. I'm now going to look at the South Downs Way, Alfriston. I'll look at those areas. And funny enough, I was sort of killing time last Sunday and I saw a church, 597 AD, St. Augustine's, the oldest church in the United Kingdom. And there's a little pointer saying Rome, yeah. 1000 AD. So these pilgrims are doing that journey even to this day. Well, I'd certainly like to do certain journeys around the South Downs area and get to know places. So yes, I don't know how many years we have, but whether it's 5, 10, 15, 20 years, we are looking forward. Yes.
Well, I wish you luck. What I find so contagious is that you're so brimming with enthusiasm and you've got another house move.
Yet
you're going into this with the same level of expectation and an accomplishment that no doubt you brought to each of your previous ones. David, wonderful. Thank you so much for being my guest this week.
Oh, thank you very much, Chris. It was wonderful. Thank you so much.